going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
What's standing between you and your first sale on Shopify? Time, expertise, resources? What if you could multiply all three? Product descriptions? Done. Store insights? Delivered. 2 a.m. customer questions? Handled instantly. Entrepreneurs on Shopify are reaching their first sale faster with AI that works with you. Go to shopify.com/firstsale to see how entrepreneurs use AI to grow their businesses faster. That's shopify.com/firstsale.
Well, there was no doubt that the Caitlin Clark effect was unsustainable going into this year. And as anybody would have expected, viewership was down pretty sharply for the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament Elite Eight. Obviously, last year it was Caitlin Clark against Angel Reese. This year it was Paige Beckers, not against Juju Watkins, who was hurt. So the ratings, of course, down quite a bit. We'll talk about that and much more on the new edition of the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, joined as always by Armand Brody. Please subscribe to the SMW podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. There's plenty of content there. Just had a special bonus podcast put up with me and Brian Gotsky of Video Amp talking about TV ratings. And of course, the Bob Costas interview that we did a couple of weeks ago as well. So a lot of content there. And in today's episode, we're going to start with the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament. Obviously, no reasonable person expected the viewership to come anywhere close to last year, and it sure didn't. 12.2 million for Iowa LSU in the Elite Eight last year. This year's top Elite Eight contest, 3.4 million. And that is obviously just not even close in viewership. But what I would note is that the 3.4 million in question, which was for the LSU-UCLA game on ABC Sunday, was the third largest audience ever for the Elite Eight. What we kind of forget is that last year's numbers were not just records. They so obliterated the previous highs that even falling 9 million viewers short will still leave you in record-setting territory. So the numbers are still historically strong, just nowhere close to a year ago, which, again, pretty much anybody would have predicted. Armand, I'll bring you in on that note.
Glad that I'm not hearing commentary, at least I haven't heard it. I don't know if it's out there, and if it is out there, whatever. I'm not hearing any commentary about women's basketball dying. I'm glad that that's not happening, because if this were the NBA, all the bullets would be flying towards the league, metaphorically speaking. But there's something that happens when you lose not just a great player, but when you lose someone whose abilities and skills, they so far surpass and transcend what anybody else around them is doing. I think you said it before. You're talking about Michael Jordan type impact. And to some people, that may sound like we're being outrageous, but it's really true. The way Caitlin Clark captivated the sports world, and a lot of the conversations about her were not anchored in the right stuff. I'll put it that way. But my goodness, she was and is still something to behold. Something you've got to watch. It's like appointment television. And so to lose that, and then to add to that the loss of a Juju Watkins, just demoralizing. And so I think everything we saw this weekend, and there was some close activity. One of my good friends is a diehard South Carolina Gamecocks fan, rooting for Dawn Staley and the team the whole way, and was just living and dying with every play. So there was some close activity, some close games, at least one close game off the top of my head, the South Carolina game. But to not have a Caitlin Clark and then to not have a Juju Watkins, this is pretty much to be expected.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, look, the Sunday games were quite good. I actually watched more of the Sunday games in the women's tournament than the men's. You know, that dreadful Houston-Tennessee game. I mean, my goodness. So I was watching South Carolina pulled off Duke. I was watching LSU lose to UCLA. And I'll be completely honest here. You go back 2, 3, 4 years, there's no universe where if the men are playing and the women are playing, I'm watching the women. That has changed. The fact is, I watched more of the women while the men were playing. I switched away from the men's tournament. I mean, I've never done that. So obviously, viewing habits have changed, right? Because if, look, let's be completely honest here. You go back 2 years, there's no universe where you would say that the women's tournament could get 3.4 million viewers opposite the men's Elite Eight. Remember, because people don't seem to always understand, the Sunday Elite Eight games in the men's tournament are two of the most watched basketball games of the year. That's big time competition. So, you know, the women are more than holding their own. The Monday games obviously just fell off hard. And, you know, some of that is I don't feel like people are that interested in UConn. I just find that, you know, UConn on the men's side is a little bit like the San Antonio Spurs with Duncan and Parker and Ginobili. If UConn shows up in the Final Four, the ratings are going to be the lowest you've ever seen, right? 2004, 2011, and then the past couple of years. The women have never had that because they were so dominant, they were there every year. But I think you could make a credible argument, you know, that UConn's drawing power isn't what people think it is, even on the women's side. And I look at why should women's basketball be any different than any other sport in college? SEC, SEC, SEC. People want to watch South Carolina. They want to watch LSU. They want to watch those Southeastern Conference teams, right? And UConn might not have the juice. And the other thing, too, is, you know, people have been kind of trying to figure out, well, why doesn't Paige Bueckers resonate? I don't know, and I'm not going to speculate. I'm not going to get into the argument. I mean, I don't know who it was that made the argument that it was because Paige has advocated for, you know, Black players and maybe people don't like her because of that. But I don't buy that. You know, to me, she's just a good player. And you have to be more than just a good player to have the kind of impact that Caitlin Clark had, right? There's been plenty of good players. And Paige Bueckers is just a good player. And it's also true that she's in, what, year five? And has, correct me if I'm wrong, never played in the national title game? Or did she get, she got there once. She got there once when they played South Carolina. You know, I mean, they UConn kind of has the penalty of all the dynastic years and also the penalty of what have you done for me lately because they haven't really won. So UConn's drawing power, I kind of wonder about. And then the other thing, too, the other game was TCU-Texas, regional matchup, TCU, you know, I mean, look, what was it, 65-7 in the football game, lowest, least watched football national title game. I don't think Haley Van Lith is that big of a draw either. And, you know, people could make the same argument with Van Lith that they might make with Bueckers. Oh, because Van Lith, you know, been an advocate for Black athletes. Again, I don't know. I think that's getting a little bit too speculative. There's also the Sedona Prince factor. A lot of people on social media seem to really dislike her because of some of her legal issues. But I think more than anything, it's just nobody really considers TCU when they think about women's basketball. And, you know, every college team is in a small market pretty much, but they're a small market team even by college standards. So the Monday numbers make sense to me. And it's not a surprise that the Sunday games that had the bigger star teams in the SEC did better.
One of the things you've done that I've appreciated is given people context of what we're seeing ratings wise compared to 2023, not last year. Because you really can't count last year if you're trying to sort of create this apples to apples comparison about where the women's college game is, because Caitlin Clark just blows everything out of the water. And so some of the comparisons to 2023 make more sense. I also recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, some of the games were played on Easter weekend last year, right? That's the weird part about the fact that Easter as a holiday moves around. It's not on the same date every year. But I would imagine that has some impact on ratings, does it not? Or could?
You make a great point. It's one of the reasons why the Sunday numbers are even more impressive to me. The men's tournament on Sunday was down big. Those games were down substantially from a year ago because Easter Sunday in the out-of-home viewing era has become a big viewership day. Most watched opening weekend NBA playoff game since 2002, back in 2022. Most watched final round of the Masters since Tiger won in 19, back in 23. And last year, most watched Elite Eight game on the men's side since 2019, and most watched Elite Eight game on the women's side ever. Of course, that record was broken the very next day. So Easter moves the needle. Men's this year down big from last year in Easter. Women were up. So the women's games were down massively on Monday, down 55 and 81%. I mean, you don't see 81% declines, right? But on Sunday, the LSU-UCLA game was up nearly 40%. That's kind of incredible considering that last year was on Easter. So those numbers were quite good. Obviously, look, like I said, SEC, 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 right? I mean, people seem to enjoy those teams. And Kim Mulkey's a star. Blau Jay is still there. Dawn Staley is a star. You know, South Carolina and LSU have built up programs, like real programs. And unlike UConn, which of course is the program in women's college, they are in a bigger conference. They are in, I wouldn't say bigger markets, because obviously UConn has the New York market, Boston. But I think regionally, like you're talking about the whole Southeast, you know, with LSU and South Carolina. And frankly, you could add up the entire Southeast and it still wouldn't match up to New York City. But I don't think UConn has all of New York City. You know what I mean? And of course, LSU and South Carolina don't have all of the South. But I get the sense with the SEC, they watch each other's teams, right? This is not the National Hockey League where if your team is out, you're done. With SEC sports, they're going to watch SEC teams. And I think that that helps out.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Close your eyes and imagine what you'll look like 6 months from now. How's your hair look? The same? Now picture how your hair would look if you started using Hims. If you're picturing the same you as before, but with much thicker and fuller hair, you'd be correct. What can happen in 3 to 6 months? You could pick up a new hobby and get not that good at it yet. You could do about half of your New Year's resolution. You could learn a few songs on the piano or pick up bass guitar. Or you could start seeing thicker, fuller hair regrowth through Hims. Not bad for just 3 to 6 months. Men, if you're starting to notice your hair thinning when you look in the mirror, you're not alone. Life just gets busier and busier, and it can feel like there's not enough time in the day to do something about it. So, try Hims Hair Loss Solutions. You can avoid jumping through a bunch of frustrating hoops and get access to treatment without even leaving your home. Hims provides you with the convenient access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Choose from personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatments to find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online, so there are no uncomfortable doctor visits. Answer a few questions and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, and they can help you get your confidence back too with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results may vary based on studies on topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with the healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
All right, let's shift gears. You talked a little bit about the men's tournament. And obviously, you know, with the men's tournament, as I mentioned last week, the first weekend is always going to get pretty much the same number, 9-point-something million viewers. There's always going to be a CBS press release. Oh, my goodness. Most watched ever, every single year. And people will go, oh, wow, the tournament. Wow. The true measure of how the NCAA men's basketball tournament fares in the ratings is the second weekend onward, because that's when you don't have every team. Now you just have, okay, what is the field? This year, nothing but blue bloods. I think the expectation was, because you have nothing but blue bloods, you're going to get great ratings because you're going to get great games. But the games were not great. These were subpar games, really across the board, the exception being Florida's comeback against Texas A&M. And so the ratings really weren't very impressive. And the thing about Sunday's numbers, because the Saturday numbers were great. TBS did quite well Saturday. The Sunday numbers were some of the lowest for Elite Eight Sunday in memory. The late game, which was Michigan State and Auburn, was the least watched late Sunday Elite Eight game outside of 2 years ago, which was Miami, Texas, since 2016. That late Sunday Elite Eight window last year, because of Easter, was the most watched of the whole tournament. The most watched game of last year's tournament was NC State over Duke in that late Sunday window. So that's the kind of drawing power that that window can have. And this year, not so much. Viewership for the tournament is even. Entering the Final Four, tournament should still end up with an increase. And the reason I'm saying that is we have four number one seeds. You know, so far the blue blood's the chalk. It hasn't worked out. We haven't had good games. I cannot imagine we have 4-1 seeds and we get subpar games on Saturday. You got to think we'll have high quality basketball. So if that happens, you'll see an increase. You'll probably see an increase anyway, because the last year was on cable and this year is on broadcast.
Never get over the fact that the national championship and the Final Four are on TBS every other year. It never feels right. And I always have to remind myself during the even years that it's on TBS, because it just doesn't feel right. I'm a massive Carolina Tar Heel fan, and to have Carolina Duke in the Final Four on TBS just doesn't sit well with me to this day. But it is quite different to have NC State Duke as your Sunday afternoon, that late game, Elite Eight game, and then have Auburn Michigan State. Just doesn't quite hit the same way. And I was curious as to where Duke would end up for both weekends. Had a feeling that they would go far, but I was curious to see where would they land. Would they land on the Thursday-Saturday side or the Friday-Sunday side in their regional semifinal and regional final? Because from a rating standpoint, there was nothing else in, at least from my viewpoint, there was nothing else in those two rounds that was going to move the needle like Duke did. Because even though you had well-known teams, well-known names, you did not have Cooper Flagg is the face, if you will, of the tournament on the men's side, but he's not nearly the kind of needle mover that a Caitlin Clark or Zion Williamson was, but the Duke brand now has become so large, so important, so embedded within the identity of men's college basketball that you can sort of coast on that a bit. You can lean on it, and typically it'll get you over the top. And I say that as a Tar Heel fan, so nothing but objectivity on this podcast, buddy. But it just seemed like, first of all, like you said, the games did not have that oomph, and that's been the magic really has not been there on the men's side this year. But then to have Auburn, Michigan State as your second game, Tennessee, Houston was a dreadful game. It was not entertaining at all. Houston controlled it. I told somebody, I said, so let me get this right. You've got Tennessee playing Houston in Indianapolis, and all I could think of was C.J. Stroud and the Indianapolis Colts, Tennessee Titans, and Houston Texans. It was just weird, and the game was not entertaining at all. And so you sort of put two and two together, and you get four, and you just come up with a really lackluster Sunday afternoon of Elite Eight basketball.
Yeah, I mean, that was a terrible game. You know, you mentioned Duke falling on the Thursday, Saturday. What a weird decision. Duke always plays on, you know, the Sunday. Now, there have been years throughout this whole journey with the tournament where a really high-profile team gets the Thursday, Saturday. Kentucky, when they were undefeated, they got the Saturday, on, and it was on TBS. You know, but I don't really, I mean, I guess I'll put it this way. It's an equal partnership. CBS and TBS are equal partners, but they're not equal. CBS is where you get the most viewers, right? Now, I know that, you know, they have to, I know that they have to throw TBS a bone, and really more than that. I mean, they're collaborating. So TBS will advocate for itself. But if Duke is playing in the Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, their Elite Eight game needs to be Sunday on CBS. I mean, and look, the viewership was quite strong on Saturday. But your ceiling on Sunday in the 5 o'clock window on CBS is far beyond what it is Saturday at night on TBS. So you're not maximizing your audience with that. I was surprised to see that that decision was made. Because the other thing, too, you have Iron Eagle and your lead team doing Auburn, Michigan State. We all know that's not the biggest game of the weekend. This is Cooper Flagg. And I know he's not drawing. I know he is not the draw that people expected him to be. But he's still the biggest star in the tournament. He needs to be in your featured window with your number one broadcast team. And the other thing, too, Michigan State, it's a lot like UConn. It's got that San Antonio Spurs vibe. They're a great team. They're a great program. But they're not Michigan. Michigan is a big draw, right? They are a team that people may respect, but they don't tune in to watch them in that way unless you're playing Duke.
Right. And CBS tried to lean hard into the Tom Izzo stuff, and I get it, but I'm sorry. Tom Izzo and Michigan State is not going to sort of bring about this excitement and this brand awareness, this brand recognition, and this must-watch quality the way Duke does. If for no other reason than the fact that people still want to see Duke lose, because even though the narrative has changed a bit, they are still sort of the New York Yankees, the evil empire, the enemy number one, public enemy number one in men's college basketball. If you put Duke on the late game during the Final Four, you would think that Duke would have also been on that 5:05 Sunday afternoon going into 60-minute spot on CBS. Just a strange thing that Duke did not get that prime spot, considering everything that Duke means to college basketball and the college basketball ratings.
Yeah, absolutely. They're the Lakers. You know, they're the Lakers and the Yankees. And, you know, it matters. It matters when you slot a team, which, by the way, before we get this out, Easter is in a couple of weeks, and it coincides with the opening weekend of the NBA playoffs. So just putting it out there, you know, for the folks who put together the NBA schedule, if the Lakers are playing or the Warriors are playing, or especially if the Lakers are playing the Warriors, that needs to be Sunday at 3:30. Do not waste that on the Saturday night, because the audience that the NBA could get for a Warriors-Lakers game one on Easter Sunday. Well, there's quite a bit of public relations value in the kind of number that the NBA might get there. Do not put that on Saturday night. What a terrible error it would be if they did that. It matters when, you know, the time slots matter. And Sunday afternoon is better than Saturday night. You know, one of the things I find so interesting, you know, not to go on a tangent, the men's tournament has been committed for so many years, Saturday night, Monday night. To me, it's fairly obvious that the better ratings play is Sunday night and Tuesday night, or Friday night and Sunday night, or Sunday evening. Sunday, you know, Sunday 5-6 o'clock, you know, you could do the national semifinals then, or the national title game. I think that's a lot better than Saturday night. And it helps the women's tournament out too, because the women are stuck with ABC, and we can't preempt America's Funniest Home Videos. So we got to put the national title game on at 3 o'clock. That can be avoided if you were to swap the men and women in the dates. The women could get, let's say, Saturday and Monday. And while we're on the subject of television ratings, let's talk a little bit about some of the other stuff going on right now. And, you know, opening day, Major League Baseball last week. This is the final season of MLB on ESPN, unless something changes. And I will say, Rob Manfred seemed, in his interview with Chris Russo last week, to leave a little bit of the door ajar. But if it is the final season of ESPN, Major League Baseball coverage, they certainly started with a bang. With the most watched opening day game since 2020. And if you take 2020 out, because that was the anomalous year, the COVID delay, big audience for the first game, take that out, most watched opening day game since 2018. That was an afternoon matinee, Brewers-Yankees. Out-of-home viewing, obviously, is a factor here. Factor in everything. But certainly, based on the numbers we have, pretty impressive. You know, ESPN is still ESPN. ESPN is getting still, for the most part, pretty solid audiences for its game. MLB might really want to consider what it's doing in terms of leaving ESPN. Because the other thing, too, you know, maybe ESPN, they want a pay cut. They want to pay less. If you can figure out a way to make that work for you, that might be smart, right? Because when someone wants you to cut the amount that you're paying them, or that they're paying you by, you know, more than half, they might be amenable, in order to facilitate that, to some other things that might benefit you. Like, for example, maybe you can find a way to get them to bring back baseball tonight, right? Maybe you can find a way to get them to focus more on your shows, on your highlights. Maybe you can bring something like intentional talk back on ESPN2, there's just opportunity there. I know MLB was insulted by the ESPN offer, but there's reason to try to make it work. And I think the ratings certainly play into that.
I'm trying to remember, John, the last time the Yankees had a home game on ESPN on opening day. That's not something I recall seeing. You help me out if you can with that.
I think that'd be 2021 against Toronto. 2021 against Toronto, I think. I'm not sure, but fairly recently.
Okay.
Fairly recently.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, having the Yankees and the Dodgers on your air, on your network, to open the season, that's pretty good. I know that Tigers-Dodgers game was up from Cubs-Rangers last year. But, yeah, I mean, everything you're saying is on the money, and it's something we've been talking about for a while, and every other person who's respected in sports media has been essentially saying the same thing. ESPN and MLB makes too much sense together. There's just too much. It makes too much sense. And so I am glad, I guess glad's the right word, that Manfred has softened, I'll use that word, a bit, on his tone and his approach, because we are aware of the statement that got out to The Athletic and how that was brought forth. And we even talked about it here on the podcast. But it's just a case of, look, from a business perspective, it makes too much sense. like you said, I know Major League Baseball was insulted by the offer. I get that. MLB also made some mistakes along the way. The Roku deal, the Apple deal, we've discussed that as well. But, I mean, let's just face the facts. It makes too much sense for ESPN and Major League Baseball to be together. And when you see the ratings that Brewers, Yankees, and Dodgers, Tigers got for opening day, those numbers, in my opinion, just validate that point, that argument, illustrates the point that ESPN and MLB just need to, they just need to keep it rolling. It's been going on for more than 30 years, and it needs to continue.
Yeah. Well, you know, since, you know, common sense does tend to win out. I mean, not broadly, but certainly in the context of sports rights. And look, the reality of the matter is, if you're MLB, you really think you're going to get a better deal. I mean, the other thing too, MLB could carve up ESPN's rights and still keep ESPN in the fold. Okay, you want to pay us that much less? Then we'll give the Home Run Derby to Fox, right? We'll give the Wild Card Series to somebody else, and you can just have Sunday night. I mean, I don't know if ESPN would be amenable to that, but that's a possibility too. This has too many ways to make it work for MLB to be strident. I will say, I do think Rob Manfred did himself a favor with the Russo interview. He came off very reasonably, much more reasonably than the text of his memo. And the reality is, I still feel like he's trying to misdirect people a bit by making it a comment about ESPN's coverage. But, you know, look, I think, you know, it's fair. I mean, obviously, you know, you're trying to go from $700 million, you know, less than a decade ago per year to $200 million. That's pretty stark. And given what you're paying the NBA, and we all know the NBA is more valuable than baseball on a national level, even if baseball gets better ratings occasionally, because the NBA actually sets aside valuable content for national TV and didn't sign ridiculously low rate deals with, you know, streamers. You know, baseball in a lot of ways is responsible for the size of that gap that it has with the NBA. But look, I mean, yes, we know that ESPN's paying a lot more to the NBA. Yes, we know ESPN's way more invested in the NBA as content, which is not necessarily a good thing. And let me say this about Sunday Night Baseball. I respect everyone who does that broadcast. You know, I think they are good people. I like Eduardo Perez. I like David Cone. And I think, you know, Carl Ravitch has more than earned the right to have that assignment. I do think ESPN probably, ever since they got rid of John Miller and Joe Morgan, has not known what to do with Sunday Night Baseball. They aren't putting their 100% best foot forward on that broadcast. And it's a lot like Monday Night Football used to be, where they just kept on going internally. And by the end, hey, I like Steve Levy. But Steve Levy as the voice of Monday Night Football was not, you know, it was a little bit off, right? And Steve Levy is great. I'm not trying to insult him, but he's, you know, this is Cosell and Al Michaels. I mean, it's a lineage that you're talking about somebody who, when he does college football, he's not even on the A-team, right? That was the other thing. They kept bringing in secondary college football guys to the NFL. It was crazy, right? So I get that same sense with Sunday Night Baseball. This was Miller and Morgan. And John Miller never did a World Series on TV, but he did a lot of World Series on the radio, as his successors have. But John Miller, with his lyrical voice, almost impossible to duplicate, was really, really, really good. Joe Morgan did do World Series on TV. He did the World Series with Bob Costas on NBC. That was a high-quality booth that they got rid of because, like, the guys from Parks and Rec were criticizing the Joe Morgan on the internet. Is that what it was? Is that the reason they got rid of their best ever baseball team? But, you know, and they never figured out. A lot of great announcers have come and gone on that team since, and none of them have ever been able to match Miller and Morgan.
I will say it was pretty cool to hear Joe Buck do baseball again. And I love the fact that he had a former Yankee on one side and a current Milwaukee Brewers analyst on the other side to balance things out there from a perspective standpoint. But ESPN has about five play-by-play men who are better than Carl Ravage. Think about this. John Shambi does the World Series for them now on radio. I have no idea why John Shambi was not given the lead spot when Dan Shulman stepped away from baseball. It made no sense. Sean McDonough comes in to do the postseason for them, for ESPN. McDonough's done World Series. You've got McDonough. You've got Buck. You've got John Shambi. Heck, Kevin Brown, who does the Orioles games and also works with ESPN, he's a better play-by-play announcer than Carl Ravage. So I do agree that I agree with Manfred that ESPN has not put its best foot forward. That's not the battle he should be fighting, in my opinion. There are bigger battles for him to fight, but it doesn't mean he's not right. So it's a matter of which battle to fight, not whether or not he was telling the truth. But there was some accuracy, at least in my opinion, to what he was saying. But yeah, ESPN and Major League Baseball belong together like peanut butter and jelly. Hook it up. Let's get a sandwich going. Let's keep this thing rolling.
I will say, don't forget Dave Fleming. I don't know. Yeah. I don't think you mentioned him yet.
Yes.
I would actually say, and I don't watch enough baseball to be able to say this confidently, I think Dave Fleming is actually the best play-by-play voice that they have on MLB, just from the little bits and pieces that I've heard of him over the years. So you're right. Ravage, that's a loyalty play. That's Levy on Monday Night Football. And Ravage has made too many big mistakes in high leverage situations to still have that role. And I feel bad saying it because I like Carl Ravage, but I have to, also be honest here. He's made, he's not a number one guy on MLB. You know what they need to do? They need to back up that Brinks truck for Joe Buck. They need to say, we're going to put Joe Buck on Sunday Night Baseball every week. And we are going to, I don't really know what they could possibly do to get Joe to agree to that. We are going to, build a statue for him, in Disney World. I don't know what it is, but they have, Joe Buck sat down in that booth and sounded like, it was like, wow, what a relief. Things are back to normal. I'm listening to baseball as it should be called. You have Joe Buck. Use him. Now, you're going to have to romance him. I don't know how it's going to work. You might have to double his salary or something. I don't know. But there's got to be an offer that you make to Joe Buck that he cannot refuse to get him on Sunday Night Baseball every single week of the season.
Or even a Sean McDonough would be a possibility there. Another guy who's done World Series. Now, granted, he's older than Joe, not as connected to baseball over the last 20 years as nationally as Joe Buck is. But I'm with you. But remember this too, John. ESPN at one point had Jason Benetti, Joe Davis, Adam Amin. Had all three of them at one point.
And Joe Davis.
Joe Davis was...
On ESPN?
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that.
I recall Joe Davis doing like ESPNU level games maybe a decade or so ago. But at one point, ESPN had all of them and let all of them go. And now all three of them are at the upper echelon of baseball voices. I think Benetti is outstanding. But just like they did with, as you said, Monday Night Football, made a lot of missteps with the announcers they let go on the baseball side as well. And you end up with a booth that is good, but does not. I mean, when Joe Buck comes on the air and speaks to you about Brewers Yankees, you feel something. And fans want that. Fans, the experience, just like Burke Magnus acknowledged that the experience, the production of Monday Night Football needs to be better. That same idea, that same mentality needs to be applied across the board for Major League Baseball as well. And Joe Buck does that for like nobody else within ESPN's walls can do.
I noticed that Manfred was effusive in his praise of Fox, which was odd. you know, because he was being asked specifically about Fox not sending announcers to do the games in Japan. MLB is in a very interesting position. They have completely devalued national television to protect RSNs, and the networks realize that, and the networks pretty obviously are not as invested. It's not just the NBA on TNT that's better than baseball on TBS. It's the NHL on TNT that's better than baseball on TBS. The effort level for the NHL on TNT far exceeds that of MLB on TBS. They don't even go to the LCS anymore. They went to the LCS when Costas did it a few years ago. They were on site. They hardly ever go to the LCS. They're not invested in MLB. Maybe that changes when the NBA's gone. But why would they be invested? They get one non-exclusive game a week. What in the world is that? Right? And then with Fox, you know, I mean, Fox has put together, in terms of, obviously, Ortiz, Rodriguez, and Jeter and Burkhart, the best studio team in the history of baseball on TV. Slim pickings, but it's the best studio team in the history of baseball on TV. You know, I remember the days, and I mean no offense to Jeannie Zelasco and Kevin Kennedy, but that was not a great team, right? They had Keith Olbermann and Steve Lyons, if you go back even further, you know, but the team they've got now is the best baseball studio ever. But ultimately, you know, Fox gets a little bit too much credit here. They're still doing remote broadcasts, correct me if I'm wrong here, regularly on FS1. You know, I mean, MLB doesn't have a single relationship that is as good as what the NFL has and what the NBA has on games. I want to be clear, on games, because there's a lot of problems with NBA studio coverage. But MLB doesn't have a single partnership that's as good as what the NFL has in the studio and on games, what the NBA has on games, and what the NHL has in the studio and on games. And it's Major League Baseball, which just had, in their World Series, a higher audience than anything that you'd see in the NBA since before COVID. But baseball has devalued its national TV over and over and over again. And the result is, you know, the networks recognize it. The networks recognize it. And the other thing, too, they are paying hardly any money for these rights, realistically. And yet they're still feeling like they're paying too much because MLB went out and said, hey, Roku, for $10 million a year, you can have an exclusive game every week. You know, ordinary fans could band together and kind of scrape up enough money through, like, loans to be able to acquire a baseball game of the week. I mean, this is ridiculous. So there's a lot. 2028 can't come soon enough for MLB. They have to rethink everything. And I don't know if Manfred is the man for the job.
Quick question, and then I'll leave it alone. Next year, or 2027, you're watching baseball on television. Are you watching MLB on ESPN?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll say so. MLB likes to say, oh, we're going to take our ball and go home. They did it in 1999, and the result was a 6-year extension. And that went to the courts, and they still came out with a deal. I don't think ESPN will keep everything it has. I think MLB will split the rights and carve out things like the Home Run Derby for Fox. You know, but ESPN, to me, makes... First of all, if I'm Comcast, why am I getting baseball now? I mean, if I'm anybody, if I'm Comcast, if I'm Netflix, if I'm Amazon, why am I getting baseball now and not waiting until 2028? Why am I bidding now on the remnants of ESPN and not waiting until 2028? ESPN doesn't need Sunday Night Baseball. In fact, they don't, you know, MLB needs ESPN for Sunday nights more than ESPN needs MLB. I wrote an article the other day. They can plug in tons of programming to fill that programming spot. You know, to me, the easiest thing is just to stay the course. You have this appointment programming. It gets a 7-figure audience every week. You don't really need to think about it. Set it and forget it. Works for MLB, works for ESPN. And I would say that makes the most sense to me. And MLB can figure out what they can do with the wild card series, with the Home Run Derby, maybe even with opening day. But when it comes down to it, the only thing that makes sense is for ESPN to still have a game of the week. All right, let's shift gears before we go here to the news that came out earlier this week that the National Football League will schedule a Christmas tripleheader this year. No real surprise. You know, Hans Schroeder said last year, "Hope we're going to do two games." Look, when Hans Schroeder talks, you probably should just assume that what he's saying is not necessarily written in stone. Obviously, the NFL tends not to leave a lot of, if there's an available audience, the NFL will try to claim it. Anytime you talk about the NFL on Christmas, you see all the headlines. Oh, man, the NFL's really coming after the NBA now. Oh, wow, the NFL's taking Christmas from the NBA. The NFL isn't taking Christmas from the NBA. If the NFL wasn't playing on Christmas, yeah, the NBA would get more viewers on Christmas. That's true. But the overwhelming majority of the 24 million people who watch the NFL on Christmas would probably just watch Christmas specials, right? The difference in popularity between the NBA and NFL is such that the overwhelming majority of people who watch the NFL aren't really watching the NBA, even if there's no NFL. So no, the NFL is not taking Christmas from the NBA. The NFL is taking the available Christmas audience that already isn't watching the NBA, right? I mean, and the other thing too, if you want to say that the NFL is taking Christmas from the NBA, it only applies in one circumstance, and that's when the Christmas NFL game is on ABC. Then, yes, the NFL is coming after the NBA in that scenario because it prevents the NBA from being able to have its five simulcast arrangement on ABC. As long as the NBA has all five of its Christmas games airing on ABC, the ratings are going to be in line with historical norms. They're not going to be great. They're not going to be multi-year highs, typically. But I would say this, the numbers that got people so excited 2 years ago when the NBA had its least watched Christmas ever were more a result of the league only having two of its five games on ABC than anything else. So that's my perspective on that. The NBA is going to have to compete with the NFL on Christmas pretty much every year for good. And I think the league will probably be fine. It lowers the ceiling on the audience that it can get. But again, if the NFL wasn't playing, the majority of the people who are watching the NFL wouldn't just go to the NBA. They'd be watching other stuff.
Lakers-Warriors got a really good number on Christmas 2024, did it not, John?
Yep. It did. It got nearly 8 million viewers, and there was no NFL game in that window. You're not going to get that, but I'm looking at the average. I'm saying, yeah, the ceiling will be a little bit lower, but you go back 2 years to when you had all five games on ABC and there were three NFL games. The NBA averaged something around like maybe 4.3, 4.4 million. Again, that's in line with the historical norm. You go back to 2 years ago when ABC only had the two games, was what, 2.8 million? Like that is what I think you're not going back to so long as you have those five simulcasts.
And it sounds like, according to some other reporting, the Chiefs, according to The Athletic, or was that The Athletic? Yes, it was. They've requested to the NFL to continue to be on Christmas as they were this past December 25th when they took on the Pittsburgh Steelers. So it sounds like that's going to become a thing. Could have Cowboys, Lions on Thanksgiving and Chiefs on Christmas. Once the NFL says, after initially saying they would not, by the way, once the NFL says, oh, we're going to put Wednesday Christmas games on Netflix and have the teams play on Saturday leading into Wednesday, all bets are off. I mean, at this point, if you haven't gotten the memo, the NFL is king. And the NFL, if they want to put programming on a Tuesday afternoon, as they did with COVID during the COVID year, a Wednesday on Christmas Day, a Friday to slip in right before Labor Day weekend. If the NFL can do pretty much whatever it wants. I don't like the sort of the thought process that says, oh, this is the NFL intruding. I think LeBron James said it last year that the NFL was, you know, encroaching on their territory, on their turf. Look, man, the NFL owns all the turf on television. They own it. Yeah. They own it. And so this to me is just par for the course. I am curious, John, and maybe I'm making too much out of this. I'm curious to see what some of those holiday special numbers look like in the post-LeBron, post-Steph Curry era. What does it look like for the NBA then? Because we know the NFL is going to just continue to be rolling. And you'd have to think that within the next 3 to 5 years, we'll see both LeBron and Steph out of the NBA. I would be curious to know what the numbers look like in that time frame, as opposed to sort of being able to rely on them now, even though both of them are past their prime.
Well, I mean, the reality is that the NBA's got some lean years coming up, because none of the new kids are breaking through. Now, I will say this. Victor Wembanyama, $5 million for Spurs Knicks on Christmas this year. You know, there's an audience potentially for Victor Wembanyama. You got Luka Doncic in LA. You're never going to have LeBron and Steph again, right? You know, it's been amazing, all the whining and complaining, the hue and cry about LeBron James. Oh, no, I can't believe we have one of the greatest players ever for 23 straight years, and he's playing well into his 40s. Oh, what a terrible thing. You know, it's going to be rough when he and Steph Curry are out. But, I mean, it's not going to fall all the way off the cliff. I mean, I do think that there are still some stars. And really, more than anything, you know, it's an opportunity to try to build some new stars. And I don't know how capable ESPN is of doing that. But certainly, the NBA's got some new partners, a new ability to promote, the league that's coming up. So I think that's a good thing. And, you know, like I said, I will say this. I don't think the NFL has taken that much from the NBA in a typical year. Because I really think when it comes down to it, the audience that the NFL is attracting on Christmas is obviously a sports audience. Obviously, there are people who would have watched the NBA who wouldn't. But I think most of it is people who would have been watching It's a Wonderful Life or Bad Santa or, you know, some other Christmas special and, you know, maybe just spending time with their family. It's a bigger, broader audience that the NFL has than the NBA. And that's part of the reason why. Hey, the NBA, in a bad year on Christmas, the worst year that they ever had on Christmas, 2.8 or 2.9 million viewers for the course of, let's see, how many hours? Five games times 2.5 hours. That's noon to 1 a.m. That's still pretty good. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, to me, I don't see the problem for the NBA. There's people who think that the NBA shouldn't even compete with the NFL on Christmas, which is crazy. There's more than enough audience available. The only year when it's really bad is when the NFL is on ABC. And, you know, other than that, you're typically going to get 4 million, 5 million. And once this big data thing really matures, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll see the NBA at 6 million, 7 million, even with the NFL at 30 and 31 million. If you're still getting your biggest audiences of the year, it's worth it for you.
So let me get this right. What you're saying is everything is going to be fine? Are you offering a measured approach, John? Is that what you're doing?
I'm trying. I don't know what the point is at this point, because that stuff doesn't go viral. It doesn't, doesn't resonate. You know, people want to feel that surge of emotion about things being all or nothing. And it's, you know, that's not where I am.
Here's the reality. The NFL is going to have its games on Christmas. Amazon's going to have its one game. Netflix is going to have its doubleheader. The Netflix games will probably be produced, I would assume, by CBS again. The Amazon game will be what it'll be. Al Michaels and Kirk Herbstreit will call it the whole thing. The NBA will have its games. A lot of people will watch the NBA games. More people will watch the NFL games, and nothing will have changed in terms of how both those leagues should be viewed. Because keep in mind, folks, the NBA's got almost $80 billion coming to it from a collection of network/streamers. And the NFL is the conquering king of television, and they've got money coming out of their wazoo from everybody. So, yeah, I think what John and Armand are saying here, folks, is everything's going to be fine. The numbers are going to be what the numbers are going to be. Comparing the NBA ratings to the NFL ratings is just kind of dumb to me anyway. because it's not like we don't have a history of knowing what's going to draw, what's going to attract more. I mean, come on. The NFL trumps everything and everybody. These are not competitions. This is one league has one audience. The other league has another audience that is, it's not going to be in the same category and shouldn't be treated as such. And Christmas 2025 is going to play out that way. Somebody will talk about it for a day or two, and then life will go on.
Yeah, you know, those viral tweets will make it seem like it's a bigger deal than it actually is. It is generally the way it tends to go. Before we go, I would note, you know, all the hue and cry about NBA ratings this year. The interesting thing to me has been to watch how the people in the league, you know, people like Chuck, people like even Draymond, active players, have taken the baton from people on social media tweeting about NBA ratings like it's some kind of emergency, from people with political beefs. You know, I don't actually believe that the ratings this year, which I guess now are, I'm not sure if the NBA will end up catching last year. The last couple of days, we're taping Wednesday. The last couple of TNT doubleheaders have been weaker than I would have thought. So I don't know if they'll actually be able to catch last year, but basically the league has narrowed the gap. Got some very strong potential matchups in the playoffs. You know, I just don't think the ratings, even when they were down 20%, were an indication of anything necessarily wrong with the game to the level that people have been complaining about. I mean, it's been totally kind of, you know, as Regis Philbin once said, it was his favorite expression. You can look it up. It's been bonkos. It's been bonkos. Do look it up. Look up Regis Philbin and bonkos, and you'll see the real story. It's a Seinfeld related. Before we go today, I do want to express my condolences for the passing of Robert McChesney. So I will start by saying this. If you enjoy my writing, I try not to be too self-aggrandizing here, but I think my writing is a strength. I think that's something I'm really good at. You can credit that to Bob McChesney, who was a scholar, somebody who wrote a lot about corporate media, media consolidation. If you have ever seen my my bookshelf, you know, in a class that I've taught, or in a production meeting, a Zoom meeting, or like Armand can see, I've got tons of McChesney books back here. He was on my dissertation committee, so I obviously worked with him. And, you know, someone who really knew how to communicate to people. If you've ever read academic writing can be a real pain to get through. Just people who are almost allergic to the concept of making people understand what they are saying. If you've ever read Bob McChesney's books, and, you know, obviously left-leaning, but I mean, frankly, honestly, given how much conservatives complain about corporate media, I honestly think there's genuine value in his writing, even for people who are conservative. But, you know, that's another story for another day. If you've ever read his writing, clear, to the point, he is not trying to impress you and overwhelm you with, you know, his vocabulary. He writes in a way that you can understand, and not in a condescending way, but in a way that you can actually understand the concepts that he's trying to advance, because the goal of his work is for you to understand what he is trying to tell you, not to go, wow, look at all these words. That's not the goal of his writing. He was a huge influence in terms of me reading his work before I became, a student of his, and obviously being a student of his. So I did want to just mention his passing. He passed away last week at 72. And a real giant of critical political economy, which, you know, I'm not going to get into critical political economy on this podcast, but certainly something that, again, even if you're right of center, if you have a critique of, you know, the legacy media, you know, think about giving it a read. It's interesting stuff. You don't have to agree with all of it, but it's interesting. Just wanted to say that.
There is nothing more valuable in this space than having the ability to write well. When I taught, I used to tell my students, one of the things I'm most grateful to my mother for is my mom had me reading at a really early age. She just drilled it in me. And I used to tell my students when I taught, I said, master reading as much as you can. Because if you can read well, you can write well. If you can write well, you can speak well. If you can speak well, you can tell a story. And if you can tell a story, you can do just about anything. And so to hear you talk so fondly about someone who means so much to you has me thinking about some of the professors I've had along the way. Many of them are still in my life. One of my college professors is a mentor to me to this day. We compare notes. We talk about the industry. Phone calls end up lasting 40, 45, 50 minutes. My high school principal is still in my life. Both of them attended my wedding. And so to have those kinds of people make impact in your life and have the opportunity to honor them is a pretty sweet thing. And my condolences to his family and, of course, to you as well.
There's so much value in the corporate media critique to understand the industry that we're in. It's important to know about media consolidation, especially covering sports media. We are in corporate media consolidation. Everything at WBD is a result of that, right? I mean, we're talking about a company that's that has changed hands so many times. So there's a lot of value in it, and I hope that I've advocated for it in such a way that maybe some of you will read some of that work. All right, hey, another podcast down and many more to go. We hope to have some more guests down the line as well. Like I said before, there's plenty of content from the last few weeks. Bob Costas, Brian Goski, George Sedano as well. And then some guests from the past as well. Hannah Storm and, I was remembering I had Taylor Twellman on a couple of years ago as well. So plenty of guests, plenty of content, and plenty of hopefully valuable sports talk. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Ramon, for joining me. And we'll be back next week with more stuff.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.